Western Libya city following a heavy storm. Thank you for joining us. The top stories for this hour: Tehran says the presence of terrorists in Iraq's Kurdistan region and their threat to Iran's security go against the Iraqi constitution as well as friendly bilateral relations. The Iranian foreign minister said no side should be allowed to undermine the security of Iraq's neighbors. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a meeting in Tehran with Abafel Talabani, the leader of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Amir Abdullahian pointed to the solid Tehran-Baghdad ties and called for the speedy implementation of a security agreement between the two sides. For his part, Talabani highlighted his party's measures to boost security along the borders of the Kurdistan region, saying that Iraq will not allow any harm to come from its territory to regional countries, particularly Iran. Under the security deal with Iran, Iraq has vowed to disarm and relocate terror groups based in its Kurdistan region by September 19th. Iran says the deadline will not be extended. Writer and political analyst Saeed Shahabi says Western countries are backing terrorist groups in Iraqi Kurdistan to achieve their goals in the region.
Northern Iraq has become a soft place, a soft ground for the Western countries to make it ungovernable, unruly, and to station those groups whom they can utilize and exploit to put pressure on Iran whenever they need to do so. So it is a weapon. This terrorism is a weapon. It's not the enemy. The West is not totally against terrorism as a phenomena. They don't like it when it is going to be to affect them. But if terrorism is to be used against their foes, then they have no problem with that. So now, why doesn't Iraq imprison them? It's not as simple as that, because it's not up to Iraq to imprison them, because then the Americans will intervene and they will put a lot of pressure on Iraqi government to release them.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the world is on the verge of a transformation which will see arrogant powers falter. Ayatollah Khamenei says the hegemonic power of the U.S. and some European countries has weakened and will further weaken. The leader also says new regional and international powers will also emerge as part of the transformation. He made the comments in a meeting with the people of the two southeastern provinces of Sistan and Balochistan and South Khorasan. Ayatollah Khamenei added that Washington is plotting to foment crisis in Iran by focusing on ethnic and religious differences as well as the issues of gender and women. The leader, however, dismissed such plots as wishful thinking. He said Iran is quite serious in confronting the enemy that's adamant in conspiring against the nation. Firas Al-Najim is the manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights. He joined us earlier with his take on the recent remarks made by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution regarding the weakening status of the United States.
You know, it's pretty evident that Imam Khamenei's wisdom has exceeded many of the leaders in the world. And whenever he speaks about a certain matter and gives a very great analysis. And with the developments that we are seeing now, we see that the U.S. is very, very weak, and it's in the lowest probably in its history, especially with the Biden administration. I mean, this administration is very weak. Biden, you know, whenever he goes out to any type of event or comes out to speak, he's always, you know, very... He doesn't know what to say, and he's always falling apart as well. Even when he's going up the stairs or anywhere, you can see that the U.S. president is not a strong president anymore. And the U.S. has destroyed a lot of the world and the politics that they got involved in a lot of countries. People have lost trust in them because they put the world in a lot of different ventures and adventures, and they failed miserably.
The U.S. reportedly plans to give Ukraine long-range missiles packed with cluster bombs, despite widespread concerns that such munitions can cause civilian casualties. U.S. officials say the administration of President Joe Biden is close to approving the shipment of the weapons. The U.S. delivery cluster munitions in 155-millimeter artillery rounds to Kiev earlier this year. Cluster munitions are prohibited by more than 100 countries. They typically release large numbers of smaller bomblets that can kill indiscriminately over a wide area. Those that fail to explode pose a danger for decades. The U.S. military believes these bombs will help Ukraine push back against Russian forces. Russia has frequently warned against the influx of Western weapons to Ukraine. It says the move will prolong the Moscow-Kiev conflict that erupted in February last year. The leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has left Pyongyang for an official visit to Russia. North Korean media said Kim Jong-un left on his private train in a trip that will include a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Kim's accompanied by top government officials, including military personnel. The Kremlin has described it as a full-scale visit, saying the main topic of the talks will be relations between the neighboring countries. Both Moscow and Pyongyang have denied U.S. accusations that they had conducted arms deals, but the two countries have vowed to boost defense ties. Putin is currently on a two-day visit to the city of Vladivostok, just 130 kilometers from the border with North Korea. He last met Kim in the same city in 2019. The UK Parliament has passed a controversial bill that shuts down new investigations into atrocities committed during the Troubles, a prolonged civil conflict that killed thousands of people between the late 1960s and 1998. Saipul Rezaul reports from London.
They have waited years for justice that will never come. Mark Kelly's sister, Carol Ann, was murdered during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
12 years of age. She was shot in the back of the head. She was shot behind her left ear. And there is absolutely no reason in the world that anyone can give any parent or brother or sister as to why their little sister should be murdered on her own street at the front door of her house.
Mark and hundreds more in Northern Ireland may never have closure now under the UK government's so-called legacy bill that grants immunity to IRA volunteers and to British soldiers for historical atrocities there. It's proving a huge test for Anglo-Irish relations, too. Amid a chorus of criticism from around the world, the Republic of Ireland is weighing up a human rights case against London for the first time in more than five decades.
Everyone, no matter who was affected, whether you were affected by IRA violence, paramilitary violence, by the state itself, everyone has a right to justice, some kind of justice. And at the very least, they investigate whatever had happened to their loved ones. I mean, and that's just the basics, Article 2 of the European Convention, you know.
Under the new legislation, if anyone accused of murder gives information to a so-called truth recovery body, they'll escape prosecution, an attempt, many say, by the British government to hide the truth.
Well, there were hundreds of IRA volunteers that went to jail during the conflict. But if we look at, in stark contrast to British soldiers or the paramilitary RUC, not one ever served a full sentence for the killing of civilians during the conflict. In fact, a number of British soldiers were let out early and given medals once they went back into the British Army. So there's a stark contrast between both. This is really about immunity for British soldiers.
The legislation is now going through the House of Lords, where it's not expected to receive any amendments. And after that, it's going to receive royal assent in just a couple of days. But the victims' families say it's not going to deter them in their pursuit for justice.
3,500 people were killed during the conflict between Protestants loyal to British rule and the majority Catholics who wanted to break away from it. 2,500 of those cases remain unresolved, and it's those who have already paid the most who are being asked to pay again. Saeed Pariza, London.
A major retailer is closing all of its 400 stores across the UK amid an unprecedented cost of living crisis. This means redundancies by early October for all of the 12,500 staff working at Wilko. That after no buyer was found for the homeware brand. The 93-year-old chain collapsed in August after failing to find new backing for the business. It has been struggling with strong competition from rival chains as the high cost of living has pushed shoppers to seek out bargains. Wilko is the latest major business in Britain that has succumbed to the tough economic environment. Retail sales growth has been slowing in the UK, with rising food prices forcing shoppers to change habits. The economic hardship is driven by high inflation and a series of interest rate rises. Over the past 2 days, Libya has been hit by devastating winds and heavy floods, with estimates of fatalities ranging from hundreds to thousands. This is the spokesperson for the Libyan National Army that controls the African country's east.
The latest update regarding the death toll, as the Prime Minister of Libya announced, exceeds 2,000 in Derna city only. May they rest in peace. There are also in Derna thousands of missing people, some 5,000 to 6,000 missing people, and this number could largely increase.
The head of the Red Crescent aid group in the region, however, said the death toll in the eastern city of Derna is expected to hit 250. Storm Daniel swept in over the Mediterranean on Sunday. It swamped roads and destroyed buildings in Derna and hit other settlements along the coast, including Libya's second biggest city of Benghazi. The precise number of the dead is hard to determine because communications have been cut off and a decade-long battle for power between two rival governments has hampered administration. Armenia and the US have begun a joint military training exercise amid the resurgence of tensions in the Caucasus. The 10-day exercise involves 85 American and 175 Armenian soldiers. It's taking place at two training grounds near the capital, Yerevan. The drill has drawn criticism from regional powers, Russia and Iran. Moscow called Yerevan's move unfriendly and summoned the Armenian ambassador. Tehran also said it's seriously opposed to the presence of extra-regional countries in the Caucasus. Armenia and neighboring Azerbaijan have fought two wars in the 3 decades since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Each side has accused the other within the past week of building up troops near the border. The United States has commemorated the 22nd anniversary of the attacks on September 11, 2001. There was no discussion of how Washington led the West on horrific wars and sanctions campaigns, but the impact domestically has also been dramatically negative. Rahman Mazari reports from Chicago.
It has been 22 years since the Pentagon and the two World Trade Center buildings were attacked by planes, ushering in a totally unexpected and deeply destructive era of world history. As usual, in big cities and small towns across the United States, 9/11 was remembered with ceremonies and the same propaganda slogans from decades ago.
22 years ago, hatred and terror did not win. It did not destroy America. Freedom and democracy and the very pillars of this great nation continue to endure.
The biggest domestic legacy of the death of 3,000 civilians may be the internal spying, repression, and paranoia which immediately followed and continues today.
We've gone into a permanent emergency state. That's the key. And it began right after 9/11 with the passage of what was called the U.S. Patriot Act. Everything's a crime, everything's an emergency. The SWAT team raids in America, which are crazy, it's where police are dressed in military gear here. They crash through doors in the middle of the night. They've shot children, old men, veterans. It's so far gone, it's going to be very difficult to roll it back.
Washington's unprecedented and digital domestic dragnet would soon be copied by their allies, especially the United Kingdom, France, and the European Union.
All the great dictators said this, is that we need a sleepwalking people. You need to make people afraid. Once they get fearful, it's called the government needs national security. We need to clamp down everybody. We need to arrest people. And we saw a lot of that, by the way, right after 9/11. It's a way to promote hate against everybody in the world. They don't want us to get along. They want us to disagree. And long as we're disagreeing and fighting, they remain in power.
Washington's vengeful response to 9/11 was their declaration of a so-called global war on terrorism. It is now blamed for causing 4.5 million deaths, directly and indirectly, and the displacement of 45 million people. However, there's little domestic discussion regarding the awful impact of Washington's militaristic response on the anniversary of 9/11 or on any other day.
The events of 9/11 transformed our nation and how we view our national security. It also transformed each of us individually in ways that we don't always talk about publicly.
The prisoners of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, the militarization of American society, the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, so many murdered non-American civilians. 22 years after, the list of victims of 9/11 is still growing. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. Assume that the novelty and civilization of any city relates to its ancient history, art, and architecture. Though we shouldn't forget that it's people that create history, art, and culture by their lifestyle. Sorry, sir. How can I get to Agha Bozorg Mosque?
Just go straight and then turn right.
Thank you. Now you're sure that I'm in Kashan. The city with 7,500-year-old civilization, which has become an exceptional city by its notables, from its great architects to its genius mathematicians. Anyway, I am on my way to Agha Buzurg Mosque. Agha Buzurg Mosque is in the heart of the city of Kashan, Isfahan province. This mosque was built in late 18th century. It has five floors and two courtyards above and below. One of the main points of the architecture of this mosque is that it unites the mosque and the school, summarizing all the different spaces that the school and the mosque need. This type of structure represents a sort of break with the principles of traditional design and cannot be compared to any other example, making it an architectural masterpiece. The complex is named after the theologian Mullah Mahdi Naraqi, known as Agha Buzurg. The most eye-catching feature of this place is definitely its blue and turquoise tiles, which are tactfully and beautifully placed next to each other to form interesting Iranian geometric patterns. The central courtyard and the lovely pool in the middle are good examples of this art. This place even has wind catcher that works as an air conditioner for the building. Agha Buzurg Mosque and School was registered on December 3, 1951, on the National Heritage List. Well, we are now in the area of the mosque. This style of architecture dates back to the Qajarid era. Oh, look at there. I mean the structure of the mosque, school, and the courtyards. Their connection to each other is unique. Actually, it's one of the great features of this mosque. Let me get seated on the side of this lovely pool. Tell you something? While this mosque seems to be simple at the first sight, it's a very magnificent place. You just need to discover it. And I'm going to do that. And let me add this point that mosques, among all the structures in history, are very special because they are a hub for producing knowledge and understanding for people. And this mosque is no exception. Surely it used to be a great help for the people of that time. Here is one of the most beautiful mosques of Iran. Upon entering the mosque, you can see two upper and lower courtyards and a magnificent brick dome and tall tiled minarets. The structure is made in the style of a sunken courtyard, yes. The ground floor is the location of the mosque, and the lower part, or the sunken courtyard, is the location of the school and students of religion residence. A prominent feature of the mosque is the special architecture of the Gumbat Khane, or vault, which is erected on 8 massive columns, so that cool air flows in the spaces in the hot seasons in the desert region of Kashan. Let me look at the details. Wow, look at the plaster work, gorgeous. And the tile work, wow, mesmerizing. They were skillfully made. I need my camera. Okay. The combination of these works create a special sense of spirituality. Honestly, I feel great in here. Oh, how time flies! It's time for noon prayers. Let me get prepared for the prayers and then I'll come back to discover the mosque.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. Let us ponder on these words of wisdom from Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him, the elder grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Asceticism is a desire for God-fearing and the abstinence from the worldly pleasures, while clemency is the suppression of one's anger and self-possession.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, good manner. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of good manner and avoiding flattery. Unfortunately, in today's world, we see that in the societies, the flattery is being known as having a good manner. And this is something bad. It's a bad characteristics that some people have. And on the other hand, in the society, especially in the Western society, they name it as PR or personal relation. They say it is a skill that a person has. And this bad ethical thing is being known as good in some societies, which is not a good thing. We must avoid flattery because when a person sees someone who can give him a favor, or maybe there is an important person in the society, we see there are many people who praise such a person, who try to be a good person, who show themselves, who basically are trying to show that they are the good people, but they are not actually. Why? Because when we see them with other people, with ordinary people, we don't see such manner, we don't observe such manner in them when they are with the ordinary people. And this is the sign of knowing whether a person is performing flattery or not. A person who is praising fakely and who do not pay attention to the people who are lower in class, and the one who never respect others, the one who are equal to them, the one who has a lower class, if he is not respecting them, then obviously this is something which is not known as being a good manner. Rather, it is a flattery that a person is performing. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of good manner and avoiding flattery. It is very important when we talk about the good manner, we must avoid flattery. And this is from the limits of the good manner, that we avoid all kinds of flattery. We deal with the people the way they are. And if we are having a good manner, and if we are dealing with people with kindness, it should be for all kinds of people. Rather they are rich, rather they are same in the class, or maybe they're from a lower class, maybe the people are poor, if there is a needy. So all the time when I'm dealing with such people, I'm dealing in a good manner. I'm dealing with them with a good behavior. I'm being kind towards all these people in the same way. And this shows that this good manner is a permanent characteristic in myself. And that's what I need to strive for. Islam talks about such thing. On the other hand, we have the narration from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where he says that إِذَا مُدِحَ الْفَاجِرُ, if someone praises a transgressor, if someone praises someone because of his wealth, اِهْتَزَّ الْعَرْشُ وَغَذِبَ الرَّبِ, the arsh, it shakens. And on the other hand, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or our Lord, become angry upon us. Why? Because this is something which is bad in the Islamic teachings. Islam does not like flattery characteristics of the people. This way of dealing with the people. Islam talks about good manner. Islam talks about husne khulq, which is a good manner, and having this with all kinds of people, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Years of civil conflict, complicated with the ongoing proxy war between NATO and Russia, have thrown Ukraine into an economic disaster with unpleasant consequences. War-stricken women from poor backgrounds with their men fighting on the front lines are being lured by the surrogate baby industry, a booming business in Ukraine. The insatiable thirst for rentable wombs in Ukraine has become a cause for concern, as sporadic reports on the surrogate mothers have thrown light on a medical underworld infested with abuse and corruption. Long before engaging in war with Russia, Ukraine was known as a hunting ground for agencies seeking to prey on desperate women as a hub of prostitution, a lucrative business at the expense of poor Ukrainian girls and women. Likewise, over the past decade, Ukraine has become a breeding ground for surrogacy, again with poor women bearing the brunt. Promoted by celebrities like Kim Kardashian, Elton John, and Paris Hilton, this reproductive process was worth an estimated $14 billion in 2022, according to the research company Global Market Insights. With the restriction of surrogacy markets in Thailand and Nepal in 2015 and in India in 2019, global demand for surrogacy was channeled to Ukraine, where the process is less expensive and less regulated. Controlling one-fourth of the global market, Ukraine's Biotexcom Center for Reproduction is by far the biggest player in the international surrogacy market. While the center boasts that the company has given the joy of parenthood to thousands of couples around the world, its true history and operations reveal a tragic pattern of abuse, secrecy, malpractice, and even allegations of human trafficking. A 2020 report published in Princeton's Journal of Public and International Affairs further underscored the foreign exploitation driving Ukraine's surrogacy boom, asserting, "While proponents claim that women freely choose to become surrogates, vulnerable women are often manipulated through the presentation of choice. Potential surrogates are forced to choose between providing for their families through a practice that may violate their moral beliefs or forfeiting a financial opportunity to provide for their families." Most Ukrainians do not agree with the surrogacy business and that there is a stigma attached to women who choose to do it. A Ukrainian woman who sold her womb to foreigners said to The Guardian, The only reason why I agreed to do this is just for the financial benefits. Plus, since my husband left for the front line, I need a way to support my other four children. Surprisingly enough, Biotexcom's medical director, Ehor Pachanoa, openly admitted to the Spanish investigative magazine La Maria that his company targets women from poor areas. In the words of Pachanoa, we're looking for women in the former Soviet republics because logically the women have to be from poorer places than our clients. Despite Biotexcom's promotional materials flaunting its state-of-the-art facilities and luxury accommodations for surrogate mothers, multiple reports indicate its residential centers are more like a prison than a hotel. There are allegations of Biotexcom's lack of proper care for the medical needs and complications of women who bear the babies. These cases, however, are not pursued in Ukraine's chaotic legal system. The requirements to use a surrogate in Ukraine are simple. A heterosexual couple must be married, show they are medically unable to have children, and provide at least half of the child's genetic link via sperm or embryo. On average, surrogacy with Biotexcom costs between $40,000 and $50,000, with an all-inclusive VIP package going for $71,000. The German national daily newspaper Welt obtained a large number of Biotexcom documents from 2014 to 2017 showing just how little the surrogates were paid. Each contract varied, but on average, surrogates were paid $9,000 to $14,000 for carrying a child to birth. Biotexcom often charges clients five times that amount. The Ukrainian center is also no stranger to controversy. The most shocking one was that it forged documents and faked DNA tests to allow children born in Ukraine to be sold to parents who were not genetically related to them. In 2011, Biotexcom supplied a child without a confirmed DNA connection to an Italian couple in Brescia. At the same time, numerous women who have been surrogate mothers have raised dozens of allegations, including claims that Biotexcom had failed to pay them or to compensate them for loss of a pregnancy or to cover the cost of medical complications that arose during the surrogacy. Biotexcom has also been accused of tax evasion charges linked to tens of millions of funds hidden via offshore companies registered in countries such as Latvia, Cyprus, and the Czech Republic. In May 2022, the European Parliament condemned surrogacy and called for binding measures to protect women and children in Ukraine. But in reality, little has been done to empower surrogates, protect the children, or regulate the industry. Ukraine seems to have a carte blanche in violating human rights as long as the country acts as a puppet in the hands of the Western powers.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Canada has more than doubled its annual record for land burned by wildfire. Around 16.5 million hectares have burned so far, and the damage may continue through September. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Quartz publication reported, relentless wildfires in Canada continue and may only get worse in September. The number of hectares burned so far in 2023 has reached 16.5 million, more than double what the last record was in 1995 at 7.1 million hectares. The average annual area burnt in Canada due to wildfires over the last 25 years is around 2.2 million hectares, according to the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center, CIFFC, making this year 7.5 times higher than the average. The area burned this year is staggering, but the number of fires burning isn't. In the past 25 years, an average of 6,108 fires have been recorded in Canada each year, according to CIFFC data. This year isn't any different. 6,131 fires have blazed so far, 12 of which were prescribed. But the higher area burnt indicates that the intensity of the fires are harder to control due to drier and hotter temperatures, scaled up by the onset of El Nino. As of September 4th, there are 1,073 active fires in Canada, but 706, or around 66% of them, are out of control. Authorities in Canada have only controlled 204 of the fires, while 163 are being held or prevented from spreading. The forests affected are in the boreal zone, which rings around the northern hemisphere, amounting to 1.9 billion hectares, or 14% of the Earth's land, including parts of Canada, the US, Norway, Sweden, Russia, and China. The boreal forest is one of the world's last remaining stretches of wilderness. Scientists believe that the impact of this year's wildfire may permanently alter the makeup of the North American boreal forest, where the threshold of the forest's resistance to fire has been overwhelmed. In addition to hosting bird species and other biodiversity, the boreal forest is an important carbon sink that has now released around 290 million tons of carbon emissions from being burnt. The majority of carbon in boreal forests is stored below the ground at an unknown amount, which means the amount of carbon emissions from Arctic and boreal environments is underestimated. Wildfires may reduce soil moisture even further by destroying vegetative cover. And if soil is damaged or eroded due to rising sea levels, drought, or other environmental conditions, the amount of emissions released by the boreal forest now or in the future could be much higher. Residents fled the capital city of Canada's Northwest Territories recently after officials ordered an evacuation because of approaching wildfires. the people of Yellowknife, with a population of 20,000 and other smaller communities, are leaving by car or by airlift, while the main road out of town, Highway 3, had been closed due to the fires. It was reopened recently so people could get to safety. This is an unprecedented time for the city of Yellowknife, Morgan Teta said through tears in a TikTok video released recently, adding, "This is my home and I'm really scared." Teta is a member of the Yellowknife's Den First Nation. More than 230 fires are burning in the Northwest Territories of Canada, scorching over 8,000 miles of forest and displacing hundreds of Indigenous and First Nations peoples. The population of the Northwest Territories is nearly 50% Indigenous. Residents have until noon Friday, August 18th, to comply with the evacuation order. It is the largest in the wildfire season this year so far. Wildfires have spread across Canada with greater intensity than ever before this year, with more than 1,000 fires occurring since the start of the year. On June 25th, the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center declared that the 2023 wildfire season had burnt the largest area in Canada's recorded history, nearly 52,000 miles. Canadian fires in June sent massive smoke clouds to the east coast of the United States, endangering the health of millions of residents. The air quality in some areas got as high as 486, nearing the top of the Environmental Protection Agency's 500-point air quality scale, meaning the air was dangerous to breathe. The fires in Northwest Territories started over the weekend due to lightning strikes and extreme winds that pushed the flames throughout the region. Recently, local officials issued warnings which advised residents in multiple towns and hamlets to evacuate as wildfires spread near the communities, some of which reached a level 3 threat, which is the highest on the scale, meaning imminent danger. Palestine declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be examining the curious case of Elizabeth Zerkov, the Russian-Israeli who went missing in Iraq on March 26th this year. There are conflicting stories about what she was doing in Iraq. On the one hand, it's been claimed that she's merely an innocent PhD student doing field research. On the other, it's been suggested that she's actually an Israeli spy. But which is the most plausible explanation, and what could have precipitated her disappearance? That's what we'll be discussing after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra, who's been looking at some of Zerkov's activities from 2006.
The Cradle broke the news of Elizabeth Zerkov's disappearance on 5th of July, based on information from security sources in Iraq. Hours later, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu confirmed her disappearance, claiming the Iraqi resistance faction, Kataib Hezbollah, had kidnapped her, an allegation the group denies. She is registered as a PhD student at Princeton University and is claimed to be a well-known anti-occupation activist in the Zionist entity. The news appeared some 3 months after she allegedly went missing. It was not long before a raft of old tweets were unearthed, showing that she had been in military intelligence while in the Israeli occupation forces during the 2006 Lebanon War, and that she had remained in the IOF reserves for some years after this. Was it possible, people wondered, that she was in Iraq for nefarious purposes? On the one hand, her supporters have issued howls of outrage in her defense, saying that she was a principled anti-Zionist and friend of the Palestinians. The University of Princeton, where she's a graduate student, also defended her on Twitter, indicating that she's in Iraq doing field research. However, Princeton research rules forbid grad students to travel to Category X countries, as determined by the State Department. Iraq is a Category X country. Furthermore, Tsarkov reportedly traveled on her Russian passport and thus disguised her status as an Israeli citizen, which would have resulted in her being barred from the country. The Zionist regime's statement gives a possible clue on this, saying that she was visiting on her own initiative and thus not officially as a student. This would have allowed her to vitiate the rules and also give her plausible cover should she be there on some kind of intelligence mission for Mossad. In addition, it seems Tsarkov also traveled illegally in Lebanon for 3 months on her Russian passport. She is not researching Lebanon for her PhD. In the period seemingly after she was an IDF reservist, Tsarkov had engaged in research and advocacy in support of regime change in Syria, working directly with organizations known to be Western intelligence cutouts or proxies, including Bellingcat, the Atlantic Council, and the apparent CIA cutout New Lines. When she was in Iraq, Tsarkov let it be known in media interviews in Arabic that she was not Muslim and also that she opposed Eastern influence in Iraq, meaning the role of Iran. The way she discussed this could easily be seen as encouraging opposition to Iran or its allies such as Kataib Hezbollah. This would seem a plausible reason for her to be arrested or detained by Kataib Hezbollah, though we can't demonstrate that this is what has happened.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert David Miller. Dave is an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Ali Abu Nima, and I spoke to him earlier via Skype. Ali is a Palestinian-American author and journalist, and he's the co-creator and editor of the Electronic Intifada website. He's written for the Chicago Tribune, among other publications, and his books include One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israel-Palestinian Impasse, and The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And like Tsarkov, Ali is also a graduate from Princeton University. Welcome to the show. Well, I started by asking Ali how he first came across Elizabeth Tsarkov, because he's been following her activities for some time, and the Electronic Intifada has posted a number of factually based reports about her.
I think I became first aware of her around 2010 and 2011 because she was actively promoting this online personality called Amina Arraf, who was allegedly a Syrian-American lesbian blogger who was on the ground in Damascus helping to organize the early protests against the government of President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. It turned out that Amina Arraf did not exist, that she was, in fact, the creation of an American graduate student called Tom McMaster, who was living in Scotland and who had perpetrated this massive hoax, which was promoted and believed by many media organizations and many individuals, one of whom was Elizabeth Tsarkov. And this all came to light when Amina Arraf was supposedly arrested by the Syrian security police, and that set off international concern for her welfare. It turned out that of course, Amina Arraf had not been arrested because she didn't exist. But it was our publication, the Electronic Intifada, that actually was the first to reveal that it was Tom McMaster who perpetrated this hoax.
And David, tell us about the rules for conducting research abroad from Princeton University.
So there's a procedure, of course. I mean, there are with most universities now, where you have to apply to go abroad, and you have to apply in relation to the countries, and the countries are ranked by the State Department according to ones which are advisable and ones which are not advisable, and ones where you can't go. And of course, Iraq is a country, a Category X country. You're simply not allowed to go. And it's not very clear, but it looks like you're not allowed to make use of any research that you would do